Of course, and our special guest tonight has been Bob Gleason. We'll take some calls this final hour as we talk about End of Days on Coast to Coast AM. Bob, how do you compare End of Days with some of the other masterworks of apocalyptic fiction?
Well, I think that the most of the so-called apocalyptic novels actually aren't apocalyptic novels. They're post-apocalyptic. Like if you look at The Stand, for instance, which is obviously a great novel, it has an apocalyptic prologue, and then the rest of the novel is what happened after the apocalypse. The same thing with The Road by Cormac McCarthy. The Left Behind series, there is some apocalyptic writing, but there's a huge, huge setup that goes on forever. And that the also in a lot of these novels, and the thing about End of Days was it's a long novel, and the whole middle third I describe in great detail. It's a huge cast of characters, like 40 characters and whatever. And I describe from all kinds of different angles and points of view. I describe the nuclear apocalypse, and then also what it does to the world afterwards. And there are some very, very heroic figures. You'd ask me before who the hero was, and I was kind of stumped. There's a half a dozen extremely heroic figures who are out basically to save the world, save humanity, and it has. You know, it has something of an upbeat ending, believe it or not. And the I really wanted to depict the apocalypse from lots and lots of different viewpoints, from a space station that's orbiting the Earth, that's run by an omniscient computer that sees and knows everything, and what that computer thinks of us and what we're doing. I wanted the one scene. There's a Kate Magruder is stuck in the sewers of Manhattan while the bombs are going off, and she's trying to scramble through the sewers and get off the island. There are just all kinds of different perspectives. I even do from the viewpoint of the weapons, believe it or not. And I do not know of a novel that had that depicted the apocalypse itself in that kind of graphic detail. And as I said, I put a lot of time into the book, and there's the book may be unique to that extent.
Does the Book of Revelation
also it's about man's inhumanity to man, and one of the things Left Behind is obviously a great series, but it has to do with God's revenge on humankind, and the I'm more concerned with what people do to each other. And the self destructiveness of the species, from my own point of view, that human beings, we're not fallen angels, we're risen apes, between the jungle and a glimpse of heaven, there we hang, and that thread that we hang from, can be severed in a heartbeat, and we can be dropped back into the jungle. But civilization is a very thin veneer, and I've always been concerned with how people can turn, and the species itself can turn barbaric in a heartbeat.
The Book of Revelation. Any tie-in between this and End of Days? Do you see any similarities there, Bob?
I've always been fascinated by the Book of Revelation, and it describes the sheer self-destructiveness of the species. There's one point in Revelation where an angel comes down, and let the human race know that that you've got this Antichrist, and the power of the Antichrist is the power of greed. That the Antichrist controls all the financial transactions, and that if you want to make money, you got to go through the Antichrist. And it's made very clear that the wages of this avarice are going to be eternal damnation, lakes of fire, and all that. And at one point, the Homo sapiens is given a chance to repent its greed and its lust for money, and to stop doing business with the Antichrist, and we're given a choice. You can have lakes of fire for all eternity, or you can have money. Lakes of fire for all eternity, or you can have money. And 2/3 of the human race opts for the money. And the and I've always thought there's something very profound in that, that there is there's an amazing amount of self-destructiveness, both in individuals as well as in the species as a whole. The you know, we were talking before about the how incredibly expensive nuclear power is, and also the proliferation risks of nuclear power reactors and nuclear biofuel factory. And, you know, you're asking about also how poorly secured they are against terrorist attacks. And you ask, you know, why we don't have, you know, federal troops securing them.
Yeah.
And the people are afraid to spend the money, George. It's almost like something out of Revelation.
Yeah, but they can come up with this talk.
The nuclear power plants don't want to spend the people that own them do not want to spend the money securing them. And the it almost is like something out of Revelation when you think about it.
Next up, let's go to Randy in Phoenix, Arizona, west of the Rockies. Get us started here, Randy. Go ahead.
Hello there, George. Hi, Bob. How you doing?
Hi, Randy.
I did a lot of work in a nuclear facility for the Pentagon. Matter of fact, one of my inventions was how to remotely detonate nuclear material at a distance without regard to hardening. And one of the patents you can see online, unfortunately, under the Patent Secrecy Act, under the patents removed, all the mathematics and the six pages of drawings, and then half the patent says times, 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 the two times, and those that talk about revelations will know what I just said. But anyway, and I can give you the patent number so anybody can look at that. But basically, you do not know how absolutely true you are, that how close we are to nuclear removal of the human race. And I can also say Al-Qaeda from Paraguay, Uruguay, border down there in Chile, Argentina, since the year 2000, have been taking all the yellow cake they can get their hands on and shipping it through Yemen and South Africa to Pakistan to build the nukes in Pakistan. And they probably have about two or three right at the moment because they've shipped about like 600 tons of yellow cake. And that's about three bombs that it takes to make that. And I can tell you why Saddam Hussein didn't have any nukes. I can just go on. I can tell you about Tesla. Matter of fact, that was I was tasked by Reagan, President Reagan, in his first term there to do all the work on Tesla to investigate. And matter of fact, I just gave a speech out at ASU 3 years ago in July there, and I actually got a standing ovation.
What's ASU?
Arizona State University.
Okay.
Well, they had science conference there, yes, and I was a speaker there on Tesla. And matter of fact, Tesla, when you say the word, is like the old commercial E.F. Hutton, everybody just stops and listens. But
well, we know we're close, Randy. Thanks for your call, and that's one of the reasons Bob is sparking the alarm here to get people to wake up a little bit. How to do that? Next up, let's go to Houston, Texas. Douglas, it's your turn on Coast to Coast. Hey, Douglas, go ahead.
Hello, George. Bob, I would like to ask you a question about the disposal of the half-life nuclear rods once they've been expended in the reactor in the power plant. The waste material is going down into salt domes and so on and so forth. Why can't they reprocess that stuff, bring it back up into a new form of rods that maybe a little bit less potency, but still continue to use that material to create the steam that's required for the reactor and all to produce the energy and just kind of expend all the energy out of it and cut down on storage of this material and the hazards we're leaving behind for future generations. You know anything in that area?
Yeah, I do. That the there's two reasons why. The one is that there's kind of an unholy alliance between the people that own the nuclear power plants and the environmentalists opposed the nuclear power plants. The nuclear power plant people don't want to reprocess the nuclear waste because it's too expensive. It's incredibly expensive. And the environmental people don't want it done because it creates huge nuclear proliferation problems. But once you start to reprocess it, the accounting of how much nuclear bomb fuel you have becomes very, very difficult. And it's so that you really don't know where how much nuclear bomb fuel you have, and if it's siphoned off, you don't know where it is. But you're right about the this is really quite interesting that in the case of people think somehow that Chernobyl was contained, was it 25 years ago?
Right.
In fact, they're having to build a whole new containment dome for a cost of $1 trillion. So the first one was only good for like 25 years. The second one is theoretically good for 100 years. But it's going to cost $1 trillion, and Russia doesn't have the money, so they're dunning all the neighbors, all the neighboring nations who would be, in jeopardy if Chernobyl's not properly contained. You talked about the half-life, which is somewhere between 200,000 and 300,000 years, that Russia's going to be going to spend hundreds of thousands of years trying to contain Chernobyl. And the... somebody once pointed out, when you get these toxic sites, how do you put up a sign warning people? The language is only like 5,000 years old. How are you going to put a sign that people are going to be able to read 5,000 years from now, 100,000 years from now? This stuff goes on forever. And we average, a major meltdown. The world averages a major meltdown once every 11 years.
If this goes on forever, though, Robert, how did Hiroshima and Nagasaki come back so fast?
How did Germany come back so fast? Nations are amazingly resilient. Why was it in World War I that nation states were able to fight so long and so hard? The resiliency of the modern nation state is absolutely amazing. Among other things, the Japanese are incredibly industrious people. They have an indomitable spirit.
I thought radiation though would render a place useless for thousands.
Well, that's funny, because in End of Days, that a lot of my nukes that go off, they're ground bursts. And we've never actually tested a ground burst, and that's one of the scariest things about a terrorist nuke, that it excavates an enormous amount of dirt and debris, and it lofts it up into the air, and then eventually it comes down with huge amounts of fallout. But we deliberately, in the case of Nagasaki and Hiroshima, and there was fallout, and it created a lot of leukemia. And it killed people, these were air bursts that were like, something like 1,800 feet in the air, a couple of thousand feet. And the reason we did that was you generate more fire. You do get a lot of fire from a ground burst, but the ground absorbs a lot of that impact. However, it's probably more lethal in the long run, because you're going to get a hell of a lot more fallout, and you're going to get a lot more radiation sickness. And that's the kind of radiation sickness that in the final stages, you end up bleeding out. It's really, really, really quite awful. And in End of Days, that the radiation sickness, after the bombs finally stop going off, is much graver than it was after Hiroshima and Nagasaki, though it was bad after Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Yeah, sure was. Bend, Oregon, Justin, take it away. Go ahead, Justin.
Yeah, I just wanted to say thanks, George. I always love the platform that your producer and yourself provide for people
Thank
to
you.
Share kind of great information like this. And Bob, I got to hand it to you. This is some pretty informative stuff here, a little harrowing. I wanted to comment. I thought it was kind of funny, the point you brought up about how our nuclear power plants are kind of really critical to our national security apparatus with all the nuclear weapons for our so-called national defense. And I just thought that's kind of funny because it seems like we're all kind of held hostage to our own ignorance here. But I just was wondering, you kind of mentioned as an alternative to just nuclear for power supply, you know, doing something like gas turbines. I'm just wondering, you know, why you maybe don't mention renewable resources such as solar.
I don't recommend.
I have a question that follow that up.
Yeah, thank you for correcting me, because I'm not advocating gas turbines. I merely use that as a cost effectiveness comparison. But you're absolutely right. The hope for the future is all alternate energies. I interrupted you, so I'm sorry.
Yeah, well, no, that's fine, and I'm glad you clarified, because, again, I don't want to be antagonistic to you. I'm really impressed with the information you're sharing. I just wanted to bring that up because, you know, DARPA and both the Department of Defense are heavily investing into solar energy. I mean, look at our satellite stations and the ISS, International Space Station. They use solar technology, but guess what? It actually works on the Earth, too, even in Oregon, which has more solar resource than Germany and Japan, and those are the world leaders. And I'm just wondering, you know, why should we be burning up fuel supplies when plants, NASA, DARPA, Department of Defense, all utilize something that's right there? It's a renewable energy. It's not going away right away. You know, it seems kind of crazy. And you know those petrofuel chemical power plants? Those guys are socialists, too, because guess what? They externalize their costs. We all pay for that stuff. We all pay for the side effects of burning that stuff. And we pay for the infrastructure as well. We pay for the soldiers that defend those fuel supplies, go around the world trying to capitalize on that stuff. So don't, you know, watch, you know, comparing apples to apples and oranges, because honestly, that's socialized stuff too. You know, we're all paying for stuff together. And just, I want to, you know, to the revelations point, you know, we're all kind of playing with fire here. And if you think about it, in the Bible, they say that the devil is, you know, very sly and deceitful. And you mentioned the fallen angels and how we're not fallen angels, we're just risen monkeys. Well, you know, you got to watch this deception here, because, you know, we're starting to think like we're the most high, you know, and that's going to set us up for a big fall. And I'm just suggesting that citizens should protect themselves and take action. And why don't people stand up, be citizens, and actually democratically vote something smarter that's right before our very face? In fact, it shines down on my face all the time.
And because most people are sheeple, aren't they, Bob? They will follow and toe the company line.
Yeah, and they don't think that, you know, they just don't think they're apathetic. They don't think anything can really be done. But you're absolutely right. I think the single greatest thing humanity could do would be to build orbiting solar generators. It would not only solve a lot of the energy problems, it would get us into space. And in terms of the survival of the species, we have to get into space at some point. And the late Robert Heinlein used to say the only way that we're ever really going to get into space in a major and important way is to make money off of it. And the orbiting solar generators would do exactly that. They also have all kinds of high-tech solar panels and stuff now that you can blanket the Mojave Desert. That if you had the right kind of solar panels, 90 square miles would cover most of the electrical needs of the United States. You'd have to build the transmission lines, and that would be there'd be a lot of people complaining about that, and that would be an issue. But alternate energies, and I'm particularly, you know, I'm interested in the orbiting solar generators. That really is the hope for human survival.
We're going to come back and take final phone calls with Bob Gleason in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. On our next Coast to Coast program, we're going to talk about the law of attraction. So get ready for that on Coast to Coast AM. When we come back with Robert Gleason, end of days, we'll take your final phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. We're with Bob Gleason talking about end of days. Bob, let's assume for a moment there's really not an organized Al-Qaeda, that they're just a bunch of splinter group people running all over the place. Might there be, though, out there somewhere, some organized group who went to a bin Laden and said, hey, we've got this plan, do this, here's a check, or, you know, we want the United States nuked, do this, here's a check. Do you think there's some higher-ups out there?
Yeah, I think during the last the last 15 years or so, you know, the Hezbollah has engaged in less terrorist violence. We forget, though, you know, that during the 80s, that the Hezbollah had many more attacks against Americans than Al Qaeda did. they've become a little more bureaucratized, and they're a little more, they've become like part of the government, really. There's highly motivated organizations. We're talking before, and I've talked to some, some government people about this, and the threat, it seems to me, that Al Qaeda poses now is that the way they've joined forces with the Taliban, and have these elite commando units that have been trained by the SSG. Which is the Pakistan's equivalent of Team SEAL 6, mm-hmm. And those are very highly well trained, very disciplined, very tough units, and that's the sort of thing that I find to be more more frightening, and of course also that Al Qaeda has a very active presence in Yemen, and places like that. It seemed to me that a lot of times people say why hasn't there been a nuclear strike already? And if you look at the history of Al Qaeda, that they've spent typically a minimum of 5 years planning a conventional operation, and when they bombed the African embassy, it was very meticulously planned. They spent 5 years planning that. If for argument's sake, they had enough bomb fuel for several nukes, how much time would they spend planning that? 15 years? If you spend five years planning just to blow up an embassy, how much time would you spend planning to blow up, four or five cities with nuclear weapons?
Well, because there were never any secrets, I would hope that some government that these folks were working in terms of where they might be physically, geographically located, would tip us off. Do you think they would?
It depends the kinds of secrecy that these units work in. One of the things we discovered about Al Qaeda, after 9/11, was that they functioned through cutouts. If you went up the chain of command, that the chain of command wouldn't, and Al Qaeda wouldn't always know what one of these terrorist units was doing. That they were very kind of ingenious about that, about the extent to which they not only kept their actions secret from the governments around them, they kept their actions secret from the Al Qaeda chain of command, and they acted in a very almost a deliberately fragmented kind of way. And that makes it very, very difficult to find out what a specific cell is doing if they've completely isolated themselves from everybody, including their own chain of command.
Let's go to Fort Smith, Arkansas. Chris is with us east of the Rockies. Go ahead, Christopher. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, George. Good morning. Pleasure to speak with you. I just wanted to make a couple comments. One, whenever I was in the service, my job was to work on nuclear weapons, mainly our ICBMs and our cruise missiles. And during our training that we went through to maintain these things, we were put through desensitizing training, basically forcing us to watch, newsreels and videos of what, these devices are capable of doing to human beings and animals. And it was very harrowing to see the footage from, Chernobyl, the people being burned in third-degree burns over most of their body, and it was just really, really eye-opening. What a lot of Americans don't even realize what these things are even capable of. We're always living in the shadow of fear of these things, but do people really understand what these things are capable of? One of the great resources that people could look at is a movie that came out in the late 70s that had Jason Robards and Steve Guttenberg in it. I believe it's called The Day After. It's a great movie to get an idea of, let people, have an idea of what's going on and what they're capable of. But I just wanted to put that out there and see if you had any response to that, Bob.
Okay.
Yeah, the... one of the things that what I do in end of days is that people don't always realize the extent to which the nations of Earth have proliferated a lot of those weapon systems, such as the cruise missiles. Pretty near every nation on Earth that manufactures cruise missiles is selling them all over the world. Russia has been selling their Kilo class submarines all over the world. Those submarines can be the torpedo tubes can be reconfigured to fire nuclear tip cruise missiles. They have the same diameter as a cruise missile, and of course all the nations have been selling planes all over the world, and to drop a nuclear weapon from a plane isn't that difficult because the damage is so extensive that it doesn't have to hit exactly. And so because of these systems that you said correctly are so frightening, the nations of Earth are proliferating those systems all over the world, and that's what makes the whole point of End of Days is that how really skilled terrorists backed by a small vengeful nation can foment nuclear Armageddon not only in the United States but around the world, and it's due largely. To not only the availability of nuclear bomb fuel, but the proliferation of weapon systems such as the cruise missiles, which are so frightening, you had to be desensitized in order to work on them.
What would be left of this world, Robert, if the Russians, the Chinese, we, everybody who had the ability to launch, launched?
What you'd get would be an End of Days, and that there's not for a whole lot of reasons that for instance when the Black Death hit during the Middle Ages, that they were actually much the people back then, the culture back then, could handle a huge catastrophe like that much better than we would be able to do it today. In those days, people grew their own food, and people lived and they had networks that would take care of each other, look after each other. Our average meal in the United States comes from 1,400 miles away. We would run out of food almost immediately. The hospitals, would turn into petri dishes. They would breed diseases rather than cure diseases. So much of what we depend on tech, all kinds of complicated technology, and without which we can't live. Our communication systems would collapse. We really would be horribly unprepared, to handle that kind of global collapse. And you would have cascading effects. It would be disastrous beyond belief. And then, of course, for the survivors, they would be consumed by a kind of cultural despair that would be unprecedented in the history of the world. Because Homo sapiens would have brought it on itself.
What countries would step up if Russia, China, and the United States were obliterated? Who would be left? I guess England.
Somebody argues in End of Days that the Southern Hemisphere would survive, and in the case of that novel, that they don't survive very well, and that they are also dependent on, it turns out, on a lot of Northern technology. They're dependent on, it's a very, very globalized economy. And their economy will collapse, and all kinds of bad things will happen. A lot of our ecology suffers from climate change. Unfortunately, radiation, kills trees and plants just as it does human beings, and the effect that it would have, that fallout would have on the overall global ecology. Any kind of deterioration that is caused by climate change would be exacerbated and accelerated by pandemic fallout.
Oh, devastating indeed. Let's go to Rupert, Georgia. Hey, Roy, go ahead. You're up with us.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Norrie. Mr. Gleason, you have spoken to the most fundamental question that there is before humankind today. You have said a number of times during this entire interview that that a nuclear power plant is a financial economic black hole. In other words, a private enterprise wouldn't touch it, I believe was one of your expressions. Sir, I understand that Fukushima is catastrophic by a degree of magnitude of something like 100 or 1,000 times more severe than Chernobyl. And tonight, you just shortly ago, it was said that the Russians would be 100,000 years dealing with Chernobyl. Now, if that be the case, Fukushima 1,000 times as bad. There cannot be a stronger argument. There is no stronger argument. There never will be a stronger argument for not having nuclear fission as a source of electrical energy for humankind. We got to get out of that, Fukushima is horrible in countless different ways, and so the nation of Germany has discontinued, I understand, nuclear power altogether, and humankind is going to have to discontinue nuclear power nuclear fission as a source of power for humankind. I don't see how it could help elsewise.
Well, how do you think? What do you think about that, Bob?
Well, you know that I obviously I agree. However, the nations of Earth don't seem to understand what you and I are talking about. Indonesia right now, which is in the heart of the Ring of Fire, you know, it is tsunami central. It
yes.
is, you know, all of so many of the great super volcanic explosions have come out of that. And Indonesia is trying to build nuclear power plants, and it is totally vulnerable to all kinds of, you know, earthquakes and tsunamis and that. But as I pointed out earlier, that there's 16 nations in Africa and the Mideast that want to build nuclear power plants. But and you know, the only thing I can conclude is, because they are a fiscal black hole, they're horribly dangerous, you know, that it gets you very close to manufacturing nuclear weapons. And it just seems to me that that's the attraction that nations feel. They're willing to eat tremendous, you know, costs, you know, and they're willing to socialize all these tremendous financial costs, you know, because it gets them closer to having nuclear weapons if they decide they want them.
Let's go next up to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Will's turn. Good morning, Will.
Good morning, George.
Hey, good to have you with us.
Thank you. I heard a quote from Nelson DeMille in Mr. Gleason's book commercial. I was wondering if his book, Wildfire, if maybe Mr. Gleason had heard anything about an operation like that as kind of a deterrent to a terrorist setting off a bomb in our country.
I love Nelson DeMille's novels. I really do. I haven't had a chance to really read Wildfire, but I love his books to death.
Basically, it's kind of like a non-secret that if a terrorist organization blows up a nuke in the United States, that we basically blow up a whole bunch of Middle East targets. And it's kind of like it's supposed to be
a retaliation.
A retaliation type thing.
I think that's a very plausible scenario, and I think for a lot of reasons I have to stress that is just one scenario. You know, you and I could come up with a whole bunch of other scenarios.
In retrospect, Bob Gleason, do you think after World War II that we, because we were the only ones to possess nukes, that we should have dominated the world, annihilated everybody, took the Russians out? Took out any nation that even got close to develop in any kind of nuclear power or weaponry, and at least been the only country on this planet to have this?
Well, the Russians actually wanted to have a two-way monopoly, and it was the Eisenhower administration in early 1953 that created Atoms for Peace. And decided to sell, nuclear power reactors worldwide, and really, you know, helped to create the Atomic Energy Agency, and we made a decision at that point that we would proliferate nuclear power reactors worldwide. and the it was something. Believe it or not, the Russians resisted, and we just something we wanted. In retrospect, there was a famous conversation that went on between Molotov and John Foster Dulles at the UN after Eisenhower delivered his Adams for Peace speech, and that Molotov said to Dulles that these nuclear power reactors or nuclear bomb fuel factories, you'll proliferate them worldwide. You're going to proliferate nuclear bomb fuel worldwide, and that Dulles said to him, "We'll find a way to fix that, so it won't happen. We'll find a technological fix." And Molotov said, "We don't. I don't think there is one." And Dulles had an assistant who actually took notes on the conversation and then later reprinted the conversation in a book. And he said, that Dulles was wrong. We never did find a way to fix it.
Dulles
and
was wrong. The Russian was right.
Yeah. And that was the fallacy of Adams for Peace. You were proliferating nuclear bomb fuel factories. And the United States just never took that position, George. We wanted the world to have this stuff. And it's some point I make very, very strongly. A couple of my characters make that point very strongly. And a couple of the villains throw that point. End of days, some of the villains throw that in the face of, the protagonist, saying you wanted us to have that stuff. Now does it hurt your feelings that we decided to use it? And we have not been good custodians of the nuclear technology that we invented. We proliferated it.
We sure have. But not only do we need troops around our own plants, but they need troops around all the other plants on this planet, Bob.
Absolutely.
All right. Thank you. Robert Gleason, the name of the book, End of Days, his website, robertgleasonbooks.com, also tour.com, all linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com. Scary, but fascinating. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Lautasour, Stephanie Smith, Ross Mitchell, George Nappy, and Punnett and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everybody.